You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to another and the penultimate of season one episode of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby in partnership with City Index, the global provider of spread betting, CFD and Forex trading. It says in my script, wow, what a lines we can. I'm not sure I can go with wow. It's several other words and adjectives I could use at this point, but it certainly was a lines weekend. What we can say is, wow, it is and it will be a decider on Saturday. And let's hope we get a belter of a game to finish a series that at the moment has got one or two rough edges around it. Before we get into all things Lions, we do just want to say a very quick and a very big thank you to our friends at City Index for partnering with us during the Lions tour. So much has happened over the last few weeks. We are now looking at the first Lions series that goes to a decider in South Africa in 66 years. There's a stat for you. So yeah, doesn't come around very often. We have got a lot to talk about, though. We're going to discuss the highs and lows of the weekend and everything in between. Tins is still on his holidays. He doesn't like to rush these things. Hask is alongside, as well as our very own Ellis Genge.
Bonsoir.
How are you?
Good, yeah, good.
We've done digital dating for quite a long time now. It's very nice to actually see you in person.
Year and a half?
Yeah. It's been a year and a half.
Mad, isn't it?
I've seen you a couple of times.
Yeah, a few, yeah.
Watched you carving up.
It's good to go analog rather than digital. How are you?
Yeah, all right. Weird experience, come down on the tube, but I'm here.
Yeah, you've done very well today.
Yeah, I made it alive.
Ellis's big day out, like we should do a documentary.
It's intimidating, man, coming from Leicester where obviously everything, you drive everywhere, like it's what, 40 minutes to get to the other side of the city, you come to the Big Smoke and everywhere's like an hour plus unless you get the tube, which is 5 minutes, and you get City Line, Piccadilly Line, all that stuff.
Look at you, got all the terminology as well.
Very London.
Very London. London, baby.
What a key area we're in as well.
Yeah, sick.
Lots of things to look at.
Oh, I could smell it when I got off the tube.
You can smell where we are in London. We're not gonna tell too many people, but a lot of red chinos, a lot of cream slip-ons, beige slip-ons.
You've got slip-ons on right now.
I have actually got a pair of Gucci loafers on.
You've come Gucci loafers, swimming trunks and a t-shirt. And there's a lot happening with you in your haute couture.
There is today. Actually. I mean, do you know what? It's because we're only going to see me from the top upwards.
But could be bullet naked.
Could be. I've just relaxed.
It's a very different type of show. Where are you in the world? Are you back into it? Are you hitting tackle bags? Or are you
I'm going to start running tomorrow, I think. So it's I think we're supposed to have, I think it's 5 weeks off, suggested by the RPA. I don't know what to call it.
It's a recommended 5 weeks,
yeah. And obviously, you don't want to come back a state. It's weird because, like, with the off season, I've always sort of tossed and turned between how hard you should train, because everyone's like, right, good opportunity to come back in the shape of your life. And I have to use that, yeah, fucking, I really want to come back and go well this season and be in good nick. But at the same time, like, I've been probably going for a year and a half straight, like, with the World Cup, obviously, and then after that, and I didn't play, so I was training 3 times a day over in Japan, do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like I've just been in a training camp for the past year and a half. Because it was non-stop, I decided to do nothing.
100%
right. Yeah, you know, I'd done one beach session when I was on holiday, because I felt pretty sloppy after all the Guinness. So I had a few, like, arm sessions and that, but I haven't done anything else. I'm going to run tomorrow, probably die, but I've got to do a little bit, you know, just keep it ticking up. My back plays right up as well.
I would say that the best decision you can make is actually not do anything. Keep moving, but not do anything. I tell you why, purely because no one has ever come back for a pre-season and then still not struggled in the first game and still in absolute hell as soon as it starts. You're basically, if you don't take the pre-season, you're just non-stop for 11 months of the year. There's absolutely no point doing it. And the thing is that you're already a great player. Like, I can understand if you're absolute binge juice and you need to do
something. And you want to push. And you're a young boy. Like, yeah. I remember I used to train like mad hard when I was a bit younger and stuff. But like, I've played a lot of rugby now, and personally, when people come back and PB on the Bronco, it really pisses me off.
Yeah, I know.
Because it makes you look, no, I don't make you look bad. Like, but at the same time, you're just on two different levels on that day. I feel like, look, I'll give it my all. I won't stop running.
Are you somebody, I mean, you're not old yet. You're still young.
26, yeah, getting there. I'm getting there.
But you've done a month of proper holiday. When you start running, are you going to be all right? Are you going to have to sort of ease yourself into it?
I get terrible SIJ joints, and they seize up a lot, so I tend to...
Do you get penicillin for that? Is that shagging?
No.
Oh, no.
So
it's TD, sorry.
WD-4. So
what is an SIJ joint?
SIJ. Sacroiliac joint.
Yeah, it's the bits, you know, either side of your back where you bend over, where people get like sciatica and pain.
I don't think I've ever used mine. But keep going.
Zero shagging.
Yeah, zero.
Basically, it gets stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. It gets like the more sort of upright you run. And I remember coming back from last preseason after the lockdown, like obviously we had so long off, come back in. And Aled Walters, our S&C or head of performance, he comes up to me after the run and he was like, I think we've got a lot of work to do because I ran like 6:33 on the Bronco, which like 5:30 is probably like a limit for someone who's not very fit, you know? Like you should be getting 5:30 at least at elite sport. I got 6:33. I was so embarrassed, but I just couldn't stop running. No. I was like, whatever, I know. Someone lapped me.
Yeah.
Jake Kerdaker, who's at Bristol now, he's at Argaff, he lapped me. He got 4:12. He's a hooker. He got 4:12 on a Bronco.
Yeah, but does he ever play?
What? That's not the point.
Well, I think you're fine, it is.
I said to him, I was like, Cody, you made me look a prick.
Yeah.
You've made me look a dickhead.
Yeah, day one.
But yeah, my back went, so I was literally walking like that. I remember Coley, like, I could see him laughing at me whilst I was just walking this Bronco test.
I had that as well. When you start like that, and by the end of it...
You head down like that.
Yeah,
by the end of it, you get stiffer and stiffer.
You've extended, and your legs are running outwards.
Like a chicken.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's usually what happens to me. But as soon as... Like Hass said, you're terrible on the first day and you get way better as the weeks go by. And my back sorted itself out just from repetition. And I was all right by the end of it. You always make it through it well.
Touch wood.
Yeah.
Touch wood.
Hopefully you make it.
On one day, I just didn't make it through.
No. Never
before
seen
you
again.
Know it, you're presenting a world-class podcast and doing everything to keep the wolf from the door.
Yeah. Drinking frothy coffee as you go. I sort of can't really get my head around the fact that you are starting again when... Those of us who are covering Lions tours, etc., haven't quite finished.
No. Do you know what the best thing is? You'll be running and just mojitos just going to be coming out your pores, just dabbing yourself just like
plugging
that.
Plugging a tap, you know, like your sap tap in a tree.
Dabbing brown sugar and mojitos will be coming out your pores.
We will do a lot more of this after a very good holiday, which I think a lot of us are looking forward to. Can we just quickly, before we talk all things about what's to come this weekend, just reflect on your June, July with England? How proud? How happy?
Yeah, I was
buzzing.
Yeah, well, I was just happy to meet a few new people, you know, because we've had that sort of same group for, what, 4 years, maybe three and a bit years, and it hasn't changed too much, which is rightfully so. You always got to keep your core group and stuff. People been in and out over the years, but it was just nice for, literally, I think there was like three of us who were in the squad beforehand, myself, Slady, Unders, maybe a few more, Dobby. But it was just nice to see like completely different faces and people like coming into an elite environment, something they've never done before, and just doing so well. Marcus obviously getting a Lions call up off the back of it, which was probably inevitable anyway.
Yeah,
just some of those, Adam Radwan, you know, like,
wow,
what a legend. Like, you wouldn't think
quick.
It.
Good lad as well.
Not a lad, but he's just so funny, mate. Like, he ain't like one of the boyish people, but he's quiet, Geordie lad, and he's just so funny.
Is he as fast as he looked? Because I was commentating on that game or doing the O2 stuff, and he looked ridiculous.
Mate, he is rapido. Like he makes fast people look very
slow. Is he like Johnny May, so, like a bit mad?
I reckon he's got that in him. I've been chatting to him for a bit since we've left camp, and I find he's quite weird. He's in the same sort of boat as John. He can sort of, I'd say, last in a normal world as well, whereas Johnny's always John. Right, like, Brad's is like, he can turn it on and off.
He's a Swiss Army penknife of a personality.
Yeah, I love that.
A good story about him. He had a duck called Russell. Have you seen this?
No.
Paul Hill done a quiz because he loves his quizzes.
Loves
quiz. Yeah, he's good. And then Yulzy done a round, which was like, guess the tweet. And there was a tweet from Rads and said, just found out after 3 years that my pet duck, Russell, is a girl. So I need to find a new name for it. And it was just a picture of him holding this duck. And like, it doesn't sound too weird, but that's fucking...
Why would you have,
Why have you got a pet duck? Yeah, well, that was... I had so many questions for him after that.
And what did he say? What did he explain it?
He didn't really explain it. He got a few ducks, I think.
Right.
Yeah. You know, he's just great, great value. All those Geordie boys were funny. Callum Chick, Jamie, Trev. Like just so many different characters. And it was almost like whoever's in the next squad, obviously, is yet to be known. But like to bring all those boys together and sort of see how close they could get in a short period of time and be genuinely happy for each other when they're getting capped. And there was no sort of toxicity amongst the group because like you're just getting to know each other. You know, there was genuine relationships being built, which was, it was just nice to freshen it up a little bit.
Did you find it very odd that you were like the senior pro?
Well, I thought that and then I found out there was a fair few people still older than me, but obviously just hadn't played as much, i.e. Bass and those boys. But like Bass, it was nice because it was a new environment for Bass.
I love Bass. What a boy. What a hero.
Yeah, what a legend.
What a hero.
And he was just so happy to be there. Obviously, he didn't play, did he? But he was all the time, just wasn't sappy at all. And it was just so, because he was relishing it, obviously, yeah, trying to get his first cap. And it was just so good to see. I really enjoyed my time with him.
But obviously, Alex had championed you to be captain, and then you were actually captain. So we don't want to say and sort of take credit.
What would you like this season, Ellis? Yeah. What can we get?
What can we make happen for you this year?
What can we make happen for you this year?
Lottery, please.
Fuck me, we can't do that. If we could make that happen, we wouldn't be doing this.
But how proud? And did Eddie sort of, did he chuck it at you and say, do you want it? Or did he take your side and say, I want to see what you can do at this level?
We had a few meetings with like Will Carlin and Simon. Remember Simon?
Yeah.
He's a leadership guy. He was in, I think he was a Marine. Sort of does our leadership. And I had a few meetings with them. They said, where do you sort of see yourself this summer in terms of what role you play in that? I just said, look, I just want to do the same thing that I usually do, sort of get amongst the boys. I feel like I can talk to Hask, who's 42, and then chat to someone who's brand new in Marcus, for example, who's 19, 20. I hope
22.
He's not 19. Yeah, 22, there you go. He's that young, but still very young. And I feel like I can bring those people together. So I just said, look, I want to do that. I feel like if, for example, like if you've got the captaincy as such, I don't feel like people will open up to you straight away as much as they would. And I know this sounds a bit weird for people who aren't in sporting environments, because captain's usually the person who's like got the best social skills. But I feel now in elite sport, the captain's the person who sort of sets the example in that. And I'm not perfect, as we all know. So I don't feel like that's my role off the pitch, to be doing that sort of stuff. I'm the one who I think I can make myself vulnerable. I can open myself up, do stupid shit and let other people be themselves. That was the first thing I said to the boys. We had a few beers, like Eddie always does, says, have a few beers. If you want to get loose, but just stay inside, hopefully. Yeah. Don't get too out of hand. And we had a few beers, and I just stood up and said, boys, look, please be yourself, because there's no one here judging you. I was the most senior boy in the squad in terms of caps. And I said, I don't care what you do, as long as you're not a dickhead and you haven't got an ego problem. I do not care what you do. Be yourself. No one's going to judge you. And I'd say from almost day one, every single person was 100% themselves. And I think that's why we bonded so well. Didn't get it right in the USA game, but after that and that kind of game, you could see how happy everyone was. Yeah. And we really were a team for those few weeks. And it was so good.
And was Eddie relaxed because it's summer and he wants to see what guys have got? Was he drilling people really hard because he wants to see how they can handle the pressure?
I don't think he changes. I think he's very consistent. Don't get me wrong, you've got two sides to him. You've got the sort of, he can be very stern at times, to put it lightly, and give you the bollocking when you need it. But at the same time, like he understands how much value you get out of the social side of the sport, which I really appreciate about someone who's coaching at such a high level. So he was very much so, do you need beers? Like, do you need beers tonight? Like, tell me if you need them. Like, almost like pushing it, you know? And I was like, look, fucking hell, I know it's the young group and that, but they don't want to go out on the piss all the time. Like, literally on Tuesdays and Thursdays and that, we'd have a few beers, but then we'd go out for food maybe, and just trying to really calm it down. Because like you said, we haven't been in a room like this for however long. And it was almost alien to people to be able to be in that environment.
They're all trying to make a good impression.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes hard when you've got so many people who want to taste that environment and stay in it, you all can end up being individuals as opposed to like going, actually, you're much more likely to get selected if you buy into the greater good. But it's hard for you to understand that.
It was like the first night, I basically said to, I think it was Lewis Ludlow that I said it to. I said, look, mate, I'm going to try to stay down here as long as I can, because I want people to know that you can stay down here till fucking 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning if you want, drinking red wine and whatever you want to drink. And he doesn't care. Like, it does not bother him, you know. And it was me, Benno, Lewis Ludlow to start with in that leadership group, because you've always got people that you hang about with in a squad. Lud's obviously very new to the squad. Ben's been in it for a fair bit with me. And we all hung around with different people, and Lud's obviously didn't know he was going to hang around with, so it was a good dynamic. Our big thing was have owners, like even Ben's, he don't really like drinking, and he stayed there until stupid o'clock drinking wine. He didn't want to drink it, but he was like, I think it's important to show these boys it does not matter what you're doing off the pitch, as long as you're performing on it. Obviously you're not a dickhead off the pitch, but to a degree we just wanted to really let everyone's guard down and open up, and it was brilliant.
Did you find that the responsibility actually probably made you better at what you were doing on the field? Because your performances are fantastic, especially in that second game. I found that if I was ever given any responsibility, it actually made me more professional, maybe more dedicated. I felt more responsibility. But it seems like you, A, relished it, B, did a good job of it, and C, kind of reflected in your performance.
Yeah, when I was 18 or 16 even, weirdly enough, me and Lewis Ludlow were at Hartbury together, and I got made captain and he was vice-captain. So we sort of changed hands. And Alan Martinovich, the coach at the time for Hartbury, said, I made you captain so that I could sort of, not coach it out of you, but sort of squeeze out some of the bits of your personality, I guess, and sort of mature you as a person so that you can handle then being in a squad environment. Because prior to that, I was not a bell end as such, but I was very different to everyone else. And then you sort of get not sucked in, I guess the word, you change, don't you? Like, yes. When you're in that rugby environment and you want to be a part of it then, because I got given a bit of responsibility. And then I thought, fuck, I'm the one who has to lead this now. I'm the one who has to make an environment. And I've basically done the exact same of what I did at college, is what I did at college. And I just tried bringing everyone together, done the old school sort of initiation thing and a few PowerPoints. Like when Marcus come in, he put a few pictures of him and his missus up on the thing. And I introduced everyone and I waited till Marcus at the end and I put some pictures of him and his bird. Like, just really, I just wanted people to absolutely be themselves. Yeah. And
Does he take that well? He looks like nothing sticks. He's that proper Teflon.
He's funny, mate. He's funny.
He's better, actually.
Again, like, he's, but for a 22-year-old, someone who obviously hasn't been in the squad too much, playing outstanding, who could be sour about not being in the squad, he was so good, mate. Like, he didn't know whether he was going to play or not. And obviously with Jacob there as well and the other boys, but he was brilliant the whole time. Like, come in, cracked on, trained as hard as he could. Like, it was just class to see.
I remember actually when he first came in, I think he must have only been 18 or something.
Literally.
Yeah, something like that.
Brighton, first
time. Yeah,
it was Brighton.
Yeah, I remember we were there and I think Dylan and I were giving him some shit. And because he's a young kid, obviously wasn't used to it.
Oh, he's sketchy.
Said sketchy, was like quite petulant, said something under his breath. I basically think like, I said, fuck off, Dylan. And we were like, what'd you say, mate? And he was like, nothing. I said, no, you fucking... Just watch yourself. Like that, like, you know, and obviously now, because he's been in the environment, obviously he's way more mature.
And now you're asking him for selfies. Now I'm asking him for
selfies. I'm asking him for selfies. But obviously, like, it's the same thing with any player, because I remember being at school or being when I was in the club, you know, early on, senior players, whatever you say.
Oh, you wouldn't even speak back to them.
Yeah, or if you did, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Yeah. But I just wondered, it's interesting to see that maturity, because some players with his kind of skill level can sometimes... isolate themselves. There's a few players probably could spring to mind, but we won't mention, who've sort of put themselves out there. But he seems to be very like grounded, part of the team, loves it, really puts into it. I could not be a bigger fan of him, actually.
He loves being around the boys. He buys in. Like, obviously, when he got selected for the Lions during that England game, when he came off, he came sat by me and I was like, don't worry, you ain't going to get stitched up in the social this evening. But he turned up, we had fancy dress, he turned up, put his fancy dress on, he had to go and get his vaccines, get his suitcase, go back to Brighton, get his stuff, and then fly and all that. And he come up to me, he's like, Genji, do I have to do the court session? And I was like, that's a fine. But no, I was like, mate, go say bye to everyone and shoot off. And he shot off, and he couldn't have left in a better spot, you know? That. Like, he's done so much for himself, so much good for himself to be in that environment.
I think by wearing a coconut bra and a grass skirt as he went on the line.
What was he dressed at as a baby? He was dressed as a baby.
Mate, I could not be more of a fan of him. I'm just interested, just quickly on that Lions thing when he got announced, because I talked to you post-match and you said that obviously on the field you heard someone shout, Marcus, you're a Lion, after he scored, and you were like, fuck it.
A bit nausea.
you're like, you're good, Chief. You're good, Chief. You're not that good. And you then discovered that he was.
Yeah. Well, Josh was sat behind me. Josh McAnally had done his shoulder in the week, bless him. And he went, have you seen this? And I thought, fuck, I don't know what it's going to be. I thought I was getting stitched up. And he showed me the phone. It was Marcus Smith and Lance of the Lions. And I was like, that must be so... What a feeling to come off the pitch, having played a great game for England, make your debut, win the Prem, go into the tunnel. Charlotte, who's obviously been there for years with his 20s and stuff, tell him that he's now playing with going on the Lions tour. Like, it's brilliant. As soon as I seen that, I was like, get him off, please.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
make sure he's okay.
Very pleased for Marcus, obviously. Very pleased for you as well. Genuinely, it's really, really good to see. Lots more, obviously, that we're going to chat to you about. But we are going to move on, because this week on The Good, The Bad and The Rugby, in partnership with City Index, we are joined by a man who played and coached at Munster alongside Razzy Erasmus. He played hooker for Ireland for many years. He should have been a Lion in 09, but injury ruled him out. But this year was part of the most extraordinary story in the Premiership. Quinn's playing some of the most flamboyant rugby we have seen in many a year, and going all the way to the title. It's the one, the only Mr. Gerry Flannery, who arrives with tops off, guns out. What have you been doing? I mean, you're making the young'uns look very, very old. Not quite, but the pipes are out. Have you come straight from the gym?
Well, we had our first day back at training today, so I thought I'd top off today by finishing off chatting to you lads, so I haven't changed my clothes yet.
So imagine that Adam Jones not necessarily lifting what he once was, Nick Ev still trotting along happily on the treadmill. What's happening between you as coaches now? How competitive is it?
Tobias Matson has just started with us this week, so we've just been sort of sitting in the coaches room, getting a line, saying hello to. We have a few new players in. the boys are still training. Like Charlie Mulcrone is the guy who sets the tone for the coaches training wise. He has bombed down in the gym every morning. I get in there around 6:30. The boys are in there from about 6:10 and they're smashing out Metcons, doing the ski erg, on the watt bikes, everything. They love it. Nick Evans is just like, does a little bit of skipping and then like a bit of 50 kg bench press and then he's out of there again.
Is Bomb's probably doing all those sessions and still body composition isn't changing? He's just training to maintain. It's like, if he didn't train, imagine how big he would be.
I'm not joking you, man. The guy has an unbelievable engine, and he started lifting for strength just towards the end of the season, and he was like just embarrassing, man, how strong he got so quickly. He was like whacking out like 180 on the bench, and I was like, how long have you been bench pressing? And he was like, oh, I just did it for the last 6 weeks. I was like, this is a joke.
Fucking hell. What's your bench press, Ellis?
Not 180. Fuck me.
It's a much more dynamic game these days, isn't it?
Yeah.
Speed and pace is key. It's very good to see you, Jerry. And there's a lot that we'd love to talk to you about. We mentioned Rassi, obviously, and Lions, etc. We were just talking about Marcus Smith a few moments ago as well, though, with Ellis, who's obviously had a boyhood dream stuff. As a gnarly old front rower, how envious are you of him, particularly the hair, but also just, I mean, how talented a kid, having worked with him?
I'm not really envious of his hair, but where he is in his life is it's pretty amazing the last 2 months for him, you know. He'll probably go on and do much, much bigger things in his career than he's done in the last couple of years. He's going to have a phenomenal career. You know, it's been a whirlwind for him going from, you know, how he drove things at Harlequins to then going on to getting his first cap for England and then going on to the Lions. So, I the first time is often the most exciting time when you do things. And hopefully he'll have a lot more of these coming forward. But this has certainly been a remarkable 2 months for him. But he deserves it, man. He works like a dog. The guy's on the field nonstop. You know, you're trying to please Marcus, take a break. But he's a very ambitious player.
We record this on a Monday, so there may yet be an extraordinary twist in the tale, depending on what happens when the Lions name their team. We shall see on that front. Have you been following the Lions tour? Have you had plenty of time sort of doing other things because of the nature of the day job, or have you kind of kept an eye on it?
Yeah. I was tracking it, watching all the games, was enjoying it. Got really excited when Marcus got called up. And obviously, I'm good friends with Felix and Rassi and Jack, so... You know, I see it from the other side as well. So a lot of people have spoken about like how different it has been as a Lions tour, and that they don't get to do a lot of the off-field stuff that they would normally do when they're bonding because of COVID. But I still found it really interesting, and I found the last couple of weeks pretty crazy in terms of what went down on the field and off the field.
So let's expand on that a little bit. I mean, when you say it's been interesting and sort of been crazy, I mean, a lot of people have got very, very sort of uptight about it. There's a lot being said by a lot of people across the game right now. Where do you pick a line through not only what's happening on the field, but also, I suppose, the way that South Africa have well, obviously Warren has potentially started it, but South Africa have picked up the baton and run with it?
What happened after the first test is like, that happens pretty regularly as a coach during the year. You hope it doesn't happen too regularly, but like, there'll be games when you feel like you got really hard done by the ref, and you'll try and contact them and you'll try and get some sort of explanations for things. It doesn't happen often, but I suppose when you're playing in a game like that first test was, where everyone is so incredibly physical and everyone is so committed, because you can't be anything less than that when you're trying to win one of those test games, that there's going to be things that probably start to fall outside of the laws of the game. And I suppose Rassi took it upon himself to go out and highlight those publicly, because maybe he felt it wasn't being addressed in private as quickly as he would have liked. He's the guy who risks the most there, because he's risking his own reputation, but I suppose he wants the team to win that much that he's come out and said those things.
Is it a good thing or a bad thing that he's done it? Because some people are saying it needed to happen. There have been gripes growing and growing and growing, and the system hasn't been fixed. And others are saying it's totally and utterly against everything, you know, that the game should be right now, which is ultimately protecting the man in the middle or the women in the middle, because the game doesn't happen without them.
I can't give you a straight answer on it, because I being honest, I don't know. What I would say is that like, people who are probably in the game, that they understand the frustrations that the Springboks might have had, and possibly the Lions probably have, you know, at the moment as well, when decisions don't go your way and you've trained for those things. And predominantly when you don't see consistency in officiating, and listen, I get it, it's a hard job being a referee, which is why you have systems where you can go and there's channels that you go through. But if those channels, and listen, I've not spoken to Rassi about this, so But if they feel that you need to go public with things because it's not being addressed during, you know, in the way it should be, then so be it, you know.
Jerry, would you do it? Is that something you ever think you would do?
She's I don't think anyone will watch an hour of me talking about rugby. I don't think I'd do it. Like, I think, because I've never been in that position, James. I don't know. But like, when you want to win, and when you're coaching a team, and when you want to do everything that you can to win, and you want your lads to get a fair crack at a whip. Maybe if I was put in a position where I've never been a head coach, maybe it's something I would do. I don't know, but you'd like to trust that. Like, I found referees good to deal with since I've come over here to England. You know, they've been timely. They give you good feedback, and they're always pretty honest.
I mean, I had a sort of a slightly different perspective on the video, and obviously why we want to talk to you is, you know, I want to find out a little bit more about you know, Raz as a person and your relationship with him. But I actually thought the video is an interesting one, because I think it set a precedent moving forward, because normally there's a lot of skullduggery that goes on in the media. You know, everybody uses the media as a tool to voice opinions, and I think that's business as usual. To step outside of that and use social media as a PR tool, which is that's what it's there for, but to do it sort of so vocally. But I also did think that a lot of coaches do have frustrations with referees at a time, and they seem to, referees have this unique ability where they can make a colossal mess up, and they basically then sort of turn around and say, sorry, I got it wrong, and then they move on to the next game, and maybe they're punished by not giving them the games they want. But having done this, it's now shone a light on the fact that they now can't escape. Did you know what I mean? I don't know whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a good thing, actually, because it's got to raise the standards. Whereas before, stuff, you know, they could affect games, make wrong decisions, and never be seen again. Now, it's open season. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I think it might have had a positive to raise standards to maybe reduce these frustrations. I don't know if you agree or not.
I don't agree that, you know, if you have an issue with a referee, that the way you have to, like, going forward, that I'm sure if referees have a bad game, they go home and they feel terrible. They go, yeah, I got some big calls wrong. And, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, that game mattered to so many people. And, you know, they feel bad as well. I think it's possibly what you want to see going forward is that things are handled, you know, that there's a process where if you're unhappy with some decisions, that you can address it with the referee, or you can address it with whoever, World Rugby, and it gets dealt with in a timely manner. And I presume that that's probably why Rassi went about what he did in terms of bringing that out. I don't think that should be set a precedent that now whenever you're unhappy with a decision, you go to social media. That's not the way of doing it. And trying to think that if a referee is a bad game, that you shame him now on social media is going to get better performance from him. That's stupid. But I think that it may improve the process, that when referees after a game, how much access the coaches have, because you have tight windows, you know, like you play a game on a Saturday, Sunday you're reviewing the game and you want to try and get things in position so that you can say, okay, well, we got these couple of things wrong and the referee punished us and he's going to be consistent for both teams. So we need to plan our training for the week. But if they don't come back to your boy until Wednesday, well, then you've missed half the week's training and you're playing a game the following week. So that's maybe where things will hopefully improve.
What did you make of the fact that there were sort of 27 incidents? I mean, have you watched the video out of interest?
I did, yeah.
What did you make of some of the complaints? I mean, some of them are bang to rights and these things happen in sport, and some of them are a bit like, oh, you know, that's part of the game. I mean, if you step back and you look at what the game is, it is 30 highly, finely tuned athletes. It's organised chaos within four white lines. And it's possibly more than any other sport, it's 30 finely tuned athletes who are all trying to bend the laws as much as they possibly can to try and get their team an advantage. So as a referee, you are, the job is, it's so fast, it's so all-consuming. There are so many different points which you are trying to look at.
I think rugby is probably one of the most chaotic sports controlled by one singular man. Obviously, you know, we've got eyes in the sky, but there's a lot of responsibility in that one dude, you know?
So with that in mind, is it fair to pick out 27 incidents and to sort of hang the referee out to dry in the way that he was?
I think if you put yourself in that position that you were so frustrated that you wanted to go to social media and put out a video, you probably wouldn't just pick out four or five things. Not all of the 26 are probably equally as strong a case, but Rassi probably put them all together to say, well, look, this is over one game. Here's 26 decisions. Some of them were, as you said, bang to right. Some of them probably a little bit questionable, but, you know, and on another day, you might get those decisions. So possibly all 26 of them were not all correct, but he's probably put them all together to say, well, this is in one game, 26 decisions, which some of them are very, very questionable.
Okay. I want to ask you a question, Ellis, as a modern pro player. So what was really interesting about that is there were things like the Tom Curry incident where he's scrummaging in on Ox Nietzsche as an open side. He's helping Tig Furlong as tight head. And then there are incidents where Curry arrives and he goes into the breakdown at the wrong angle. As a player, in those instances, are you 100% aware of what you are doing at all times? And therefore, when you enter a breakdown at a slightly wrong angle, are you like, I'm entering a breakdown at slightly wrong angle? Or are you like, the game's 100 miles an hour, I'm trying to catch my breath, I'm trying to work out what I'm going to be doing, I'm in? Do you know what you're doing at all times is my question.
I think, like, Jerry, I know this, in the game today, breakdown's so key, so you get coached literally to, by all means, get there before the jackler or the person going over the ball. So you literally get coached to, whatever you do, protect the ball. So you're going in as quick as you can to protect the ball. So if you do come in from a different angle slightly, I don't know, 30 degrees or 45 degrees off, then it happens. And I think, like...
But do you know that? Are you like, I'm going to chance it because...
After, when the ref blows the whistle and you think, fuck, is that me? Yeah, you're probably aware that you came in a little bit from the side. But I do think you probably get the benefit of the doubt 80% of the time. And then I also believe sometimes refs get a bit whistle happy and they blow everything up. But then obviously it ruins the game from the other side of things. I think you have to not be lenient as such, but have an understanding as a referee, like if you want the game to flow to a certain degree, like you can't just keep blowing things up. So the ones that do get missed is probably a case of the ref thinking, I've just blown one up for inside, am I going to blow another? Am I going to blow another? Because everyone's going to have an opinion, you know, like Rassi obviously thinks 26 things went wrong. I bet Warren thinks 26 things went right. So everyone's got their opinion on what happens, and I feel like the ref's the person who has to make a decision. Someone's going to think he's a prick.
I'd say it's interesting, actually, with Jerry being an active coach and an active forwards coach, is actually the one thing I was a bit sort of put off with by Razzie's thing is that so much of this stuff is about trying to get an advantage, so much stuff you're coached to do. So, for example, that Tom Curry going up and binding on a prop that angles in, I'd say, I mean, I don't know if Jerry, I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, Jerry, in case Quinn's getting pinged doing it, but I would say that I got coached to do that the entire time. Basically, if I'm on a side of a prop as a flanker and my opposite props changes the angle in and exposes the side of his body, I'm going to scrummage in on it. Now, the fact he got forced up, I would have done exactly what Tom Curry would have done, because an opportunity, the bloke's in the air, he would have done it. We talk about his lower limb clear outs. That's nonsense. The only way you can get underneath someone is sometimes to hook a leg, hook a lower limb and get him out of the way or hit him with ultimate violence. That's what you're trying to do. You've got to shift someone. So those things, he's being a bit disingenuous, because that is what you have to do. And I don't know, Jerry, if you agree, there's just so many bits that are like rugby stuff in inverted commas that you have to do. Like, and it's a constant, you know, you probably as a coach are constantly evolving how you do things. Like there was a clip where he showed, you know, we call it tackling the tackler. So for example, South Africans love to hold a player up, right? So if Ellis ran into contact and was held up by two South Africans, as a support man, the old school mentality would be to go on the ball, but I would hit whoever I could get off. So if I take one of his men off, then someone hits him, he's freer.
Yeah.
You call it tackling the tackler. But that he was trying to make out that's not something you could do. You're like, no, that everybody's coached to do that. So I sort of think there's some things where there's breaking rules and there's actually like playing rugby. You know, clearing someone out with a low body position. Imagine like Sam Underhill over a ball. Jack Willis, for example. He can flex at the hips I couldn't even dream of. He'd make John Travolta back in the day, you know, wince with how low he can get. But I don't know. It's just some of these things. I don't know what you think, Jerry, but it's sort of like, this is rugby stuff you kind of just got to get on with.
I remember actually when we played against Quinns, I don't know if, well, he probably remembers it, when Jack Kellenham was obviously amazing over the ball. He jackled one of our breakdowns. We actually scored the phase after and it got disallowed. I got sent off. I got a yellow for clearing him out with shoulder to the head. And he was so low over this ball, and I thought, right, I got to get underneath him and clear him out. I had no malice in it. It literally, he didn't even bat an eyelid, you know. He got up, walked, like, he came up to me when the ref gave me a yellow. He was like, mate, that's bollocks.
Yeah.
But no one's seen it, but like the TMO's picked it up and thought, right, how's his shoulder at the end? Has it got force? Of course it's got force. I'm going into a breakdown to clear a bloke who's jackling the ball. He's probably one of the best in the Premiership at jackling the ball. And I've got sent off for that, but how else can I, without coming into the side, without hooking his leg, without rolling him off the ball, how else can you clear someone off that ball? And like Alex said, you're making all these decisions at the drop of a pin, so something's going
to
go wrong.
I'd say, and I'll pitch the question better, Joker, so that was really long-winded. I think, do you feel like you have to have an ever evolving sort of coaching palettes of tools to deal with, that every time something's flagged now, it's just another thing off the list that you can't do and another sort of thing you have to evolve to do.
I think what you were saying at the start, like if you're a flanker scrummaging on a tight head and the opposition loose head kicks his hips out and you can see that your tight head is going to get dicked, he's going to either get driven into the air or driven backwards, well then you know you're probably going to concede a scrum penalty. So then the flanker automatically will slide up and try and square up the loose head by targeting his hips. You're going to give away a penalty if your tight head's going to get driven into the ground. So you make a decision, say, look, I'm going to slide up and try and square up the loose head. And if the referee picks that up, then he picks it up. He's right. He's right that you shouldn't have slid off him, but you were going to concede a penalty anyway. So it's like just trying to, like people just try and make the best of a situation, and the referee must apply the law as he sees fit. And Ellis, on your one, I agree with you. There's times when the jackler is that low, and when particularly when a jackler goes in initially, and it's something that needs to be probably addressed, is when jacklers go in and they don't support their body weight initially, so they drop onto the ground, elbows in the ground, and then regather the ball, and you come in and you've been coached to try and clean that out. How are you going to get him out? How are you going to get below him? It's almost impossible, and you're going to clip him in the head. So like they've got to address it that, like, if they raise the height of the breakdown by saying we're going to be unbelievably strict, if the jackler comes in and isn't supporting his body weight right from the very start, well, then we're just going to end up having head collisions all the time and we'll end up having red cards. So to answer your question, James, is that like at times when you just have to adapt, if you feel that something's going to give you an advantage and if you feel you can get away with it, you'll take it. That's rugby. Everyone just tries to cheat the best they can.
So that's a really interesting point. And I suppose the question I'm trying to get to really is, you know, Rassie Erasmus has gone through the first test. He's pulled out 27 incidents. It's not whether he's right or wrong in doing it. Either you love rugby because it is chaos, 30 guys going absolute hammer and tong at each other, finely tuned to within an inch of their life, all trying to cheat as much as they possibly can. You know, if that is the premise of the game, I don't see how you can stand back from that and go, well, he's coming at the wrong angle there.
I agree with you. Either
you're into rugby because it's chaos and you accept it for what it is. The laws are nuanced. It's like when Colby clattered into Conor Murray in the second test this weekend. I was in studio at Sky with the highest profile rugby analyst in the country right now, and everybody said red. Everybody said, by the letter of the law and what we see week in, week out here in the Northern Hemisphere, that is a red card. And they go to the TMO and they spent 2 or 3 minutes doing it, and he gets out a yellow card. If four of the brightest minds in the game can't understand what the referee's trying to do, how on earth are 9, 10, 11-year-old kids going to be able to do it? My question is sort of a macro one. Is the game now either love rugby for what it is and just let them get on with it, and of course you can check for foul play, etc., but we can't be having 65-minute halves where you're analysing, you know. Have you got a view on it, Jerry? Do we need to step back and just let the man in the middle get on with it and stop huffing and puffing about, you know, the little detail? Or do we need more detail and more analysis in real time in order to get a game that is more consistent across the board?
I'm sure Rassie was frustrated that he felt there were so many decisions that they didn't get during the game. I think, and this is just my opinion, this is not speaking to him or anything, I would imagine that the reason he did the video is because he was so frustrated at the lack of communication back and forth when he wanted to get some answers around the decision, around the 26 incidents that he had flagged. That's what I think seems to be the issue. It's actually because, like you said, Alex, like rugby is chaos. You're putting these big, huge guys on the field and you're asking them, please be so physical, you know, be so physical, that will win us the game. So they're careering into each other and they're smashing into each other. So it is chaos. So you've got to have some sort of laws there or else there'll be no game. And it's a really hard job for the referee. Everyone accepts that. Everyone accepts that it's a difficult game to referee, that it is a difficult game to play and be really, really physical and to try and keep people safe. So that's understandable. If you feel that you're not getting certain decisions, you want to know why, and you want to be able to adjust your training during the week so it's not going to happen you the following week. And I believe that was the main issue that came out of that, because you can't go around. People won't want to be a referee if coaches go on social media afterwards and just start calling them out and stuff. It just keep the communication lines open so that you can speak to them. That's the best thing that you can have from it.
So are you saying by that this sort of series stands alone as a slightly sort of more heightened example of this because the stakes are higher? From your perspective in your day-to-day, would you rather just let the referee get on with it and the team that cheats better, and you know that those are the parameters and there's less sort of recourse off the back of it? Or would you rather have more detail with the referees so that you you know what they're looking for. Do you see the difference I'm trying to get to? I'm just trying to get to a sort of a position here where have we got to let rugby just get on with what happens on the field without analysing it to death afterwards? Or have we got to analyse it in the moment to make sure it's as accurate as it can be?
Look, I think that because of what's happened with all of the concussion stuff and everyone's being so aware of that and trying to make the sport safer, there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of law changes coming in over the last couple of years and people trying to adapt to them. And it's hard enough for referees, it's hard enough for players, it's hard enough for coaches to try and keep up to speed with those things and to try and ingrain, like Genji was saying, when he comes in to clear someone out, he's not trying to think about his angle. He's coming in and just trying to be as physical as he can. And he's hoping that all the work that he's done when he's training with England and with the Tigers, that it's going to be instinctive, that he's going to be legal when he comes in there. He's going to get underneath that jackler. He's going to remove him. Otherwise, he'll always lose. The ball will be stolen because he's thinking when he should be going in and acting, removing the threat. Just the more that people communicate with the referees and the more the referees communicate with coaches, as the laws adapt, you know, how they're officiated. You look when Super Rugby came back after the lockdown and they started saying, right, we're going to start penalising, you know, teams. We're going to start rewarding the jackler a bit more. And there was like 15 to 20 turnovers in every game. And I was there, how is this going to translate to the Premiership when we came back? But then when I went back and started coaching with Quinns, it was different because the referees just had a different interpretation of it up here. So that's, you know, the more that there's clear communication between referees and between directors of rugby and coaches, and then that's filtered down to the players so that we get better habits, better practices on the field, then the game will be safer and more sustainable.
Just putting that to bed for 1 second, I'm fascinated because I never got to work with him. What's Raz Erasmus like to work with? Because obviously, you know, he sort of was the architect of an incredible South Africa comeback. You know, they couldn't win a raffle before the last World Cup, and now they obviously became world champions. He's gone from sort of coach to director of rugby to chief water boy. I mean, what was your experience of like working with him?
He's just brilliant. He's just a rugby genius, just a genius, full stop. And you know, I was coaching at Munster, and Rassi came in, and we weren't in a good shape. We weren't in good shape, and he put a real foundation into the club, and he, you know, really changed the culture in the club, and it's still standing. You know, this a lot of Rassi's work is still there, working well at Munster to this day. But like when he was with us, he's just a brilliant man. Honestly, he's just a brilliant rugby genius, and like has unbelievable emotional intelligence around the group. You know, he wasn't an on-field coach so much. He wasn't coaching a specific area. Jacques Nienaber was our defence coach. Felix Jones was our attack coach. I did the forwards. Rassi would just sit back and he would observe training, and he would come in and he would say stuff to us, to the assistant coaches afterwards, that we wouldn't have been aware of because he would just be observing it. He would see, geez, that player is a bit down. And we'd be like, well, I actually know this guy. I played with him for the last few years. Now I'm coaching him. So I'd be like, nah, I think I know. I would know if he's down. Rassi would bring the player in, and then the player would turn around a few weeks later and say, geez, man, I was mentally in a bit of a hole there, and Rassi helped me get out of it. And I just, like, he'd just be blown away the way he looks at things, the way he looks at the game. And then he would come in and he would, you know, he would speak to the group, and the group would all be 100% aligned with him. He would just have he's just a brilliant man. And look what he did. Like you said, South Africa couldn't win a game when he went there. It was the worst period in their history. They were seventh in the world rankings. And then that was 2017, 2018. Rassi came in 2019. They won the rugby championship. They won the World Cup. And they're a game away from winning the Lions now. He is not like an autocrat. He is not like this. People might want to have this stereotype of him as a big, huge South African, ruthless guy. He is determined to win, but he is, you're not that consistently successful unless you really care for people and people buy into you.
That's very interesting.
I mean, as he made, obviously working with a coach like that, we've talked about Eddie Jones on this show before about him having the understanding between being sort of a people focus and task focus.
Man, you love Eddie Jones, man.
I do.
You love him so much.
I know.
Eddie Jones pajamas.
No, do you know what it is, Joe? Because honestly, because in rugby, my experience of what you're saying a Raz Erasmus coach was like was very rare. You know, how many times in your own personal environment did you get a guy that was either a dictator, they were either very focused on the task, not focused on the people? You're talking about a bloke immediately who's
I could tell I'd want to get on with, because there's the emotional intelligence to pick up players. And I was going to ask you, everyone at Harlequins talks about the unique environment they've had this year. Like, all I hear from Joe Marler, from Marcus Smith, from Danny Kerr, is that everything you guys did was a smile on the face and was a very unique environment. You're quoted, I think, saying, it's basically talking about the unique culture. It was like a movie. The good thing about it was that it was a real team effort. There was no one person that could say they were the reason we won. I wonder how much of what Razzy Erasmus did for you and showed you that, have you taken to Quinns, and now you would add to your own coaching repertoire?
Listen, the reason that Harlequins were so good this year, man, was because the players just drove it so hard. I think, like...
But that takes a special type of coach.
It's funny you said that about Jones, because I played against you a couple of times and, had this vision. I imagine a lot of coaches looked at you and probably saw what you couldn't do well, whereas Eddie Jones went, this guy can be the most physical guy in the field. He can be a wrecking machine. I just need to make him feel good. And he empowered you, and that's probably why you love him so much. So that makes sense. The stuff that I learned from Rassi was just about, like, I was a young coach and I was there, and I just, I saw how he treated players and how consistent he was and how high standards he had. But in terms of, like, what's gone on here at Harlequins, I think it has been a team effort, but, like, the players took so much responsibility. And, it takes a certain amount of balls to go in and say to them, listen, lads, what do you want to do? Which is how we would start our spine meetings every week with the leadership group. And if you say that to them, you have to be willing to go through with it. You can't say, what do you want to do? And they say, we want to do this. And you go, yeah, I don't think so. So, like, put yourself in the player's position, is that when it's put to you and say, well, how do you think we should best approach this week? And they come up with a plan. You know that their plan, they're accountable now, so they make it work. And that was really evident. Like, you look at the way Danny and Joe and Marcus and Dommers, like, they were brilliant for us all year. And that's why it was such an enjoyable, like, honestly, until the final whistle, I still wasn't sure. I was like, I'm still not sure if this thing's going to work, because it was just, it goes against everything that I would have seen as what makes you win a rugby game. Like, our defending was almost like, it was optional for us, but they're a serious group, man, the players here, and they have a real unique culture. I don't think you could, if I go and coach somewhere else in a couple of years' time, I'm not going to go in and say, we've got to do things the Harlequins way, because it is unique to Harlequins.
What's really interesting about that is that you won the premiership, and as you said, at times defence was optional. I mean, it just, the most flamboyant rugby and so good to watch in the sunshine, in the quarters. It just sort of, it clicked. I'd love to know what you make of the way South Africa won that second test against the Lions on Saturday. I mean, that is almost the complete contrast, is it not?
Yeah, yeah. Look, I love the tests because I see how fine the margins are. And I know a lot of people were pissed off. There was so much kicking in the game. And I just saw the little mini battles, and I saw, like, how, you watch Itoje versus Eben Etzebeth, and you watch Delende against Henshaw. Like these guys are, like, some of the most physical players you're ever going to come across. And to see them banging off each other, and you know that, like, someone somewhere is going to make an error. And when they make an error, that's going to be the game. I understand that it is so different to what Harlequins were putting out towards the end of last season. But I still found it fascinating. I still enjoyed it. And to be fair, there's probably a reason that not a lot of teams play the way Harlequins do at that level, because they've short windows to come together and try and get everyone aligned. And the majority of teams play a set-piece focus game where you're transferring pressure onto the opposition, and defence is something that's mechanical. You can come in and you can say, this is how we're going to defend, this is our system, and we can force errors and we'll turn the ball over and then we'll score off them. And it's a little bit rugby by numbers. It's like percentages and being pragmatic. You'd love to see the ball being slung around. I'd love to see Marcus start the third test. Is that going to happen? Because that takes a pretty big gut check from the coach to say, I know I've coached this way all the time at Wales and I've been very successful. Now I now have the Welsh players, plus I also have the best players from three other countries. I reckon we can beat the Springboks, and then do that for the first two tests and then go, actually, let's rip that up and let's stew it, let's throw the ball around. I'm not sure if that's going to happen.
No, I'd be stunned if it does. But where do you think Gatland is right now with it all? Because it looks like they took a team to play. They wanted to play as much rugby as they could. They didn't get any tests, well, proper tests, other than that South Africa A game in the lead up to the first test, which they snuck. and now they find themselves at a bit of a hole, but without necessarily the kind of tools that he has turned to in tours past. Do you think he is there wondering how to restart, or do you think he's just going to tweak and not throw the baby out with the bathwater?
I honestly was chatting with some of the coaches here in Quinns today about it, and Bomb made a good point. He said Bomb said he made 7 changes for the last test when they were in Australia and they won the series. So he's not afraid to make changes. It's almost like, is he going to go Ali Price, then pick Conor Murray? Is he going to change his 9 again? Because it almost looks like you're not really sure what you're doing. And I suppose they weren't helped by the fact that the games that they played outside of South Africa, as you said, weren't really of the standard that they need to really test them and to find out about players. You know, like, you know, if they felt that the standard was high enough, Josh Adams would 100% be starting in the test series because he was outstanding in those games. But they may have said, well, we're not really sure if, you know, if these are just average enough club sides and we're smashing them with like the best players that Britain and Ireland have. Yeah, I honestly don't know if the ball's going to get slung around. I think Gatland is probably going to say, listen, he'll try and bring them together and try and get the mentality right. Is he going to bring Owen Farrell in? I'm not sure. But he's got a battle on his hands now trying to get momentum back, because it's really with the box going into the last series. And the fact there was so much niggle in that second test, it's not like I think the Springboks are going to be sitting back and saying, oh, we just win this game. I think there's genuine dislike in there, just from what I saw in some of the confrontations on the field. So, you know, and it's hard to out physical the Springboks. Like that is a tough challenge.
If I put you in charge, Jerry, and I gave you three key changes that you would make to Lions, what would you do if you could? What would you like to see, the vision that would help play? Because Warren obviously knows how to play a certain type of same way game. They called it Warren ball. We're not even seeing that at the moment with the Lions, not for any other reason, but they just don't seem to even be going through the phases, which I think would be a start in the right direction. But if you could change a team, who would you go for?
Oh, well, I thought the front row started well. I thought Alan Wynn and Atoje were decent. Honestly, like I spoke today and I said, geez, would you start Marcus? And Nick Evans just said to me, like, well, Jerry, he said, like, the players around Marcus, like, Marcus is a game breaker, man. He's different gravy, honestly. And I know I'm biased because I, you know, he was part of a great season for us with Quinns, but I see him training every week. I see how good he can be. I can see, if I had to defend that guy, how would I defend him? Because his lateral movement is outrageous. But the other players have to be used to what Marcus is going to do as well. So if Marcus drifts on a pass, then someone needs to come underneath him. Someone needs to come run a switch line there to hold him. Or else you just get all these guys working across the field. And I, like, Hask, I think Warren is just going to double down on what he's done in the past and back that, because that's why he's gotten this far as a coach. I don't think he can rip up the book. And I think when they didn't pick Henry Slade or Gary Ringrose initially to go on the tour, to me that kind of said that, listen, they're going to go one way and one way only. And I think that I think it's too late now in the series for them to try and just rip it up. And, you know, I'd love to see Marcus play. But I'm not sure if it would make enough of a difference at this stage now, because of the way that they're ingrained into playing. They're probably going to have 2 training sessions. That's it.
Would you risk that, though? I mean, because obviously, you know, from having an amazing international career yourself, that the disconnect between the media and fans and the reality of selection and what the right person to the right job is, it's like a chasm. You know, for everyone, for example, we'll say about Josh Adams, right? Josh Adams is obviously on fire, top try scorer in the Six Nations, scoring tries for fun on the Lions against a different opposition. I mean, the ball isn't even getting out to the wingers. And when they are, they're more often not having to make tackles. And a lot of the time, they're getting turned over in the wide channels by Mapimpi on one wing. And obviously, you know, sometimes, you know, Cheslin Colby is obviously potentially the weaker defensive player. I saw this week people talking about putting Marcus Smith. Now, obviously, as you know, every time you step up into international rugby, you think you've got shit on lockdown, and then you realise you haven't, you're still learning. That would be a huge ask to put him in, but do you genuinely think he could do a job? Because I would have said, bear in mind, he's played USA and Canada. He obviously played extraordinarily well.
I would worry
because we've seen it so many times with, like,
you wouldn't.
Matt Tate and other people. I would be concerned. I just wouldn't do it because I don't think if it went wrong, and the chances against South Africa on a blitz defence, for all the reasons you said, people not reading him, you know, it could go fucking horribly wrong if he didn't get that right.
I think you can stick him on the bench. no way you can give him attention.
I wondered. I mean, you see him week in, week out. If you genuinely back it and see that he could do it, I'd just be interested to see what you thought on that.
Well, what I would say is that, like, everything happened so quickly for Marcus. If everything had happened, let's take the season back 2 months. Imagine everything happened 2 months previous. You might go into the test series and say, okay, how are we going to beat the Springboks? And you say, well, we're not going to beat them by out-mauling them, by out-box-kicking them, by out-scrumming them, because that's what they're best at. So what can we do? And if you go, like, you've got someone like Marcus Smith who can create magic. You've got guys like Ringrose and Slade. You've also got guys like Bundiaki, you know, Henshaw, Liam Williams. Like, these guys are brilliant rugby players as well in their own right. It's just this, it's trying to bring them together and say, okay, lads, we're gonna play some rugby here. Because the only thing that's beaten the box has been New Zealand. And that's because they are the most skillful team in the world. It's fine for them. They'll go out and they'll play their way. They are the most skillful team in the world, and they beat them. For the other teams, I don't think the Lions can switch their game plan now. They absolutely cannot. Do they have enough magic to go and beat them? I think they have the players, but they've not been playing that way. And I don't think you'll get the best out of the players if you just try and switch it in two games, you know?
Jerry, if you sorry, mate, I'll give you a question. If you went into the weekend as a coach, what would you be saying to the boys? What would you pinpoint? This is how we're going to beat them. To get the boys invested, you can't just say, fuck, we're going to be more physical than them. We're going to, all the normal stuff. What would you highlight in the game? What key change would you make? Not necessarily to players, but the style of play that you think would manipulate the way the Bucks defend?
Jesus, that's a tough question, man. I suppose you probably, like, listen, off the back of, like, how things work at Quinn's, that the players are often the most important guys, and speaking to them around what they feel when they're on the field, because they're the guys who are playing. And they forced quite a lot of errors in the first test. You know, there was, like, I think the box really missed Dwayne Vermeulen. If you have a look through the first two tests and you watch when Dwayne Vermeulen has played for them, like, They gave up quite a bit in the first test, and they still give up a little bit in the second test. I suppose it's, what can you look at? I suppose you try and, like, is Faf de Klerk going to play? Is Peter Steph de Toy going to play? Things are going to happen now. Genji, I don't know what the answer in that one is. You can't just, I admit, you're right. You can't just say, lads, we're going to bar up and we're going to kick the shit out of these guys. But because you're like, oh, come on, there's got to be something a little bit smarter. Yeah. But, you know, it's, you got to have those things in your locker. You got to have been planning for those for the last 5-6 weeks rather than, like, you know, Wednesday before the third test and the decider scratching your head and saying, I've come up with a plan. So where was the plan 5-6 weeks ago? We should have been practicing this all the time, you know?
I've got a question for you. Because we obviously talked about the Alliance point of view. We put you on the spot with that. Obviously, you work with Jacques Niebuhr as well. If you're in their camp now and knowing what you know about
Niebuhr,
sorry, but fuck me. You know, I'm not here for pronunciations. I'm here for the stardust, you know what I'm saying? Niebuhr, what would you say is going on in their camp? What's the balance of power like? Because, you know, is he in charge? Is Razzy in charge? You know, what would you say they're going to be like this week, conversely to what the Lions are going to be like?
Listen, Jacques is the head coach. There's no ambiguity with that. He is the head coach. Razzy is, like I said to you, when Razzy went in with the box originally, he was the head coach. But now it looks like it's more like it operated when we were at Munster. Jacques is a phenomenal. He's the best rugby coach I've ever come across. I was retired. I never worked under Joe Schmidt. I never coached with Joe Schmidt. And, like, you speak to a lot of the Irish lads, and they'll rave about Joe. In my experience, Jacques Niebuhr is the best rugby coach I've ever worked with. Razzy is the best rugby genius, just all round best genius ever. But Jacques is a brilliant, brilliant coach. You know, like, if you see the way the Springboks play and you see how hard they defend and how aggressive they are, Jacques really puts himself in their position. Jacques, like, to defend with that kind of line speed, you are going to miss tackles. You're going to miss tackles. And if your players are concerned about missing tackles, then they're not going to bring the line speed. So Jacques will just say, it's not about tackle completion. It's about your attitude to the tackle. And he used to say it all the time when we were at Munster. He used to say, when you hit a guy, I want you to sign your name on his jersey. So when that guy gets up, he just goes, I just got fucked up by somebody. And they go, yeah, you got fucked up by James Haskell. And they go, what? You know, and he's so good putting himself in a player's position and empowering the player. Because when you're a player, you go out and you're afraid that so many things can go wrong. You know, I might make a mistake, I'll drop a ball. But Jacques just simplified it so much to just be so physical. Don't worry about making errors. You know, don't worry about making errors. And Rassi is brilliant at it as well. You know, taking, freeing the players up to go out and really, really play. And I would imagine that, like, that Jacques is just running the ship now this week, along with the assistant coaches, and that Rassi's probably just in the background now. You know, he's probably done a lot of the stuff that he needed to do in the previous week when he was so frustrated, or if he was so frustrated with the communications between the referees and World Rugby and himself. But Jacques is the boss there.
But is it Jacques? Would he focus on them being relaxed this week? Would he be intense in training? Because I know with Warren Gatland, for example, he normally, even though you might think it would be more intense, he sort of tries to keep things positive. You know, I remember the meal before the third test was burgers, you know, fish, chicken. We're like, what? What the fuck is this? Like sweets everywhere.
Feel good food.
And it's like feel good food. And he said because he, you know, when Wales beats Africa or wherever it was, that was the meal they had before, and he carries on that tradition. You know, whether do the South Africans get uptight, or as you know, are they such rugby geniuses? You said that they relax, they just keep everything smooth. Do you reckon they'll tighten ranks, put pressure on themselves? I'd just be love to know what they get like in those moments.
I'll tell you, because the week that we were preparing for Exeter in the final with Quinns, I had lost quite a few. I'd lost three European semi-finals with Munster, and I'd lost two Pro 14 finals. And I was probably thinking of myself that first week and going, oh man, can I go through another week where I pour so much of myself into it and then end up losing? And I rang Felix Jones, who's the attack coach with the box, and he was their coach when they won the World Cup. And I rang him and said, listen, I said, what were you like the week of the World Cup? And he goes, listen, he goes, we were so relaxed the week of the World Cup final. He said, like, we were just, it was just having a laugh. Everyone was real, real relaxed and calm. Because we know that when it comes to the game, we are going to physically pitch. And I just went, oh, okay. So I just tried to enjoy the week then. And I'd imagine that they're very much doing the same thing. They've been playing that game plan under Rassi, like, from the day he came in. And they would have had constant meetings and alignment camps with the players who would have been European-based players to make sure that the minute they came in and hit the ground, they could hit the ground running, that there wasn't, oh, what do we do off if we go to the edge, you know, in the opposition 22, what do we do there? All those things would have been ticked off. And to be fair, with the way COVID has come in and killed, you know, really disrupted both teams' preparations, that was essential because the time that they've had preparing for these tests has been really limited. And the fact that they are aligned and the fact that what they do is they consistently talk about their game plan, the players will have complete clarity about what is expected for them when they go to play because it's a pretty black and white, you know, the way they play. You can see that. Everyone can see the way they play. So the players will just be like pretty relaxed and just make sure that when it comes to the test that they just pitch physically as hard as they can.
I thought it was very
and I'd imagine that the coaches then are narrowing that focus in. You guys know that if you pitch physically and our game plan can beat these guys.
I thought it was very interesting that Ian Foster said this week ahead of the Bledisloe, I watched the Lions game, put me to sleep. All Blacks head coach. Adds a little spice to a great rivalry. You watched it. What did you make of it? I'd love to know, A, what you made of it, and B, where you think the Lions can find an edge.
I think I didn't watch the first test. I was golfing. not very well. But I watched the A game, and then I obviously won the first test. And in the second test, I think it's easy to stereotype South Africans in terms of the way they play. Like, they're just going to want to hit everything, very physical, carry over the top of them. But I think they really squeeze line at set piece. And like Jerry sort of alluded to then, are they going to be able to win a scrum battle? They're one of the best scrummage packs in the world rugby. Probably not. Are they going to win the Maul battle? Potentially. But who knows? It's a bit of a dice roll. So for me, if I was in that camp, if I was coaching, trying to put myself in a coach's shoes, and it's easier said than done, I'm aware of that, I'd probably not give them anything to hit because that's what they want to do. They're going to be fired up. It's like he said, it's personal. You can see that the way they're tackling, the way they're attacking, the way they're defending is personal for the South Africans. Very proud people. They lost that first test and they really want to put them to bed. So for me, what I'd do if I was the Lions, I wouldn't give them anything to hit. I'd probably move the point of attack off nine. I wouldn't be carrying it off nine. I'd probably try attack outside the fourth defender where people can't bring as much line speed and you've got a bit of a blind spot because you're always coming up and in. I'd probably try attack outside that. I'd want to play to the width. Obviously, put bombs up on Mapimpi and Colby because you've seen how much pay they got at, well, not last test, first but test. Prior to that. I don't think you go through these boys, especially in the midfield. They're ruthless, aren't they, in D? So for me, and again, I know it's easier said than done, I'd like to see potentially attack outside the 40 defender off nine and move the ball because it's harder to defend. When you're coming up quick, the last thing you want to defend is a pass on your outside shoulder because that's where you're weakest. It's inside shoulders that you want to hit with. So I'd want to see them sort of moving the ball across the front of people and trying to actually cut lines as opposed to think, right, let's bar up, let's go over the top of them. Because how well did that work for you, you know?
I mean, I looked at it and I thought that for me, there's three easy wins straight away.
Are you really confident, the Lions?
What, that they can win?
Yeah.
I'm confident if they did what they're supposed to do, that they would make it much more of a challenge.
What are they supposed to do?
So, from having watched it, every time we tackled low, so with a Courtney Law style chop low, we were able to get on turn them and start affecting stuff. All this upper body shit just doesn't suit us. They're eating yards. It means we're very difficult for us to reset in defence. You know, the South Africans won six turnovers to the one of the Lions. It's because we're not getting guys to ground. We're not getting ground quick enough, unless Courtney Law is sickling them. So, you know, for me, tackling people, getting them on the deck early. Not one of our players, apart from two or three times, is in motion when they're carrying the ball. And what I mean is, when Alice is talking about coming round off nine, right, we're getting into position, we're standing still, we're passing the ball, they're catching it, and then they're moving, which plays straight into the South African's hands.
Gobbled up.
Right, and you're running into the second and third defender. So if you could be in motion and either arc out onto that third and fourth defender and use a tip with someone coming onto a bit more pace, or just fucking coming on. Like Courtney in those first few games and in the first test, in the second half, was in motion, was getting over the game line every time. And suddenly the South Africans looked like they were a bit more trouble. And I'd say the third thing is that trying to fire a few more shots from these set piece. Like the scrum, we had three reset scrums, the ball didn't come out, and then they ended up going for a free kick, boom, got turned over. We had some unbelievable throwing from Luke Cowan-Dickie in that second test. Jerry, you got an eye for that kind of stuff. Is that first test, shaky as fuck. There was three or four pinpoint, top of the jump throws, and we've got to do more off it. Got to start doing that. And I actually think the way that Warren plays in terms of that same way pattern, you know, actually involving people getting in the phases and having a go with people in motion could cause their defence to make decisions. But if you're standing still, there's no challenge. And then we're having to kick and we're kicking probably at the wrong time. Whereas South Africa, when they're kicking or when we're going wide, we're just not having numbers there. So I would tackle lower and tackle earlier and be more aggressive and be a bit more aggressive around that breakdown area. I would be in motion the whole time, but I'd be running in threes, looking for those tips, trying to challenge that fourth defender to cut them off. And I would try to fire more fucking shots from our set piece. Put something on it. Try to go through the phases. And if it's not on, then kick it. Don't be kicking on fucking first phase unless, you know, you did what, you know, Dan Bigger did, put that bomb on and there was an opportunity to compete. But that's how you've got to beat them, because you've got to make these big guys move. But if you're running into them upright, standing still, how many times do we see him get stripped? I mean, I saw I love Ken Owens, but I saw him run into one contact with his back. And I was like, that's like, bro, that is literally all they want to do. And I think that, I honestly think that when we, in the first 10 minutes of that game, we matched their intensity. Now, you can't go harder. But Jerry, very astutely, has spotted it, because I've spoken to a couple of guys in camp. There is no love between these sides. Like, this is like personal.
Is it really?
Personal. They fucking hate each other. And there's a lot of...
Who's told you that?
I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you. But there is like a proper like, they don't like each other. There's a lot of niggle going off the ball.
I think, and again, it's easy to say, I think, like, you're right, they don't have to rip up the game plan and throw it out the window. I think if they do what they were doing already, like you said, but better and going forward first, as opposed to turning their back into contact and stuff. But like Jerry said, I do think there's a spot for someone like Marcus or a game changer. You know, like you see in South Africa, their game plan was clearly squeeze Lions, then bring on the big guns in the scrum. They brought on Lou Diaga, however you say it, for Jasper, who was a great ball carrier, but he was getting chopped every time. You know, he wasn't getting much purchase. It was very much a set-piece game. So you bring on your big lock, you put another lock behind the prop, and you get a lot of set-piece joy. So that was how they won that game. So I can see them sticking to their guns in that respect. So if I'm in the Lions camp, I'm thinking, how do we counter that? We don't want set-piece, and we don't want to be hit backwards. Yeah. So you have to move the point of contact away from set-piece, and you ain't going to carry through them.
Well, that's like Sean Edwards, like back in the day. You used to just kick the ball down the middle of the field, right between the middle of the post, never let it go out. You know, if you don't give them any line outs, what's that? You just keep running them and running. And you've got to say, the Lions have a better fitness. You know, well, apparently so. You know, after that first test,
it don't matter how fit you are, mate. When you got your skates on in the scrum, everyone's puffing.
Yeah,
you
well,
know?
Yeah, it's true.
Can I ask you a couple, Jerry, just to finish with? I'd love to know emotionally what buttons you'd press this week as a coach, or whether you just leave that to the players to sort out themselves. How do you pick up a side that has been 40 minutes away from writing themselves into the history books? I'll actually ask you as well, Ellis. How do you pick a side up that's got so close to the summit and now has got to go right back down and start again?
I suppose he's got to control the narrative that the players have in their heads at the moment. Like we're taking in information from every media outlet, from whatever everyone's opinion is coming in, flooding into us. But all that really matters is what's going on in the Lions camp. Like the two boys there came up with quite a lot of small things that would make a big difference if they went into them. And Gatland is a master at this stuff, you know. So I'm sure he's going to double down on his plan. And if you look at it, like, what are you going to face when you play the box? You've got to be strong aerially. So if he picks his back three, picks his best aerial back three, well, then that's straight away you're cutting off one avenue where they had a lot of success in the first test. So if they can get back to that, so pick guys who are going to be good in the air and then say, okay, well, we take that away from the box. If the Lions have got to sharpen up on their Maul D, if they can get ahead, the box are not the most creative team. You know what's coming. You know what I mean? If you can pitch up, it's not easy, but if you can pitch up and defend it, like if Damon Delenda is running at you, he's going to try and run through you, you know? So if you can chop him, put him on the ground, like Haska's saying, the Lions, like Curry is a machine, is a turnover machine. But, you know, it's hard to steal the ball when the guy is still going up the field. But if he's put on the deck straight away, you can get on it. So there's things that they can do. I think that the Lions bench has to have a much bigger impact because, like Ellis was saying, the bench worked fantastically well for the box when it came on, and I don't think they had the same impact for the Lions. And they're going to come for them at the scrum. I think Mako, Tighe, and Cowan Dickey, I think they got two decisions against them when they were on. But you know they are a serious scrummaging unit, and they should be able to pitch against the box. It's what they bring off the bench then, whatever way they do that there. That there's got to be. You know, when you take guys off, you want to see an uplift in performance. You don't want to see a downlift in performance. You play guys for 80 minutes. So getting their bench right, improving their Maul D and being aerially sound will go a long way for them. And then after that, then, like, there's enough brilliant players there in the Lions that, like, Warren just has to control the narrative around, listen, this is how we'll win the game. And if we do these three things well, we'll win. I was chatting to Baum about this earlier, and he was saying, well, Warren played the box with Wales in the World Cup and very nearly beat them. So now he's got all of the other best players from the other countries. So he, you know, from that point of view, you can see he's like, well, lads, we can definitely win this game. It's just I think it's going to be hard to wrestle the momentum back, but that's the challenge, isn't it?
And also, to be fair, you know, that all that goes before matters nothing until the whistle goes to the beginning of the game. You know, you're right, exactly. If the psychological point is there, he's done it. He's got the guys. Warren is the master of bringing a team together in a short period of time.
Yeah.
He makes those changes. He knows what to do. He will have identified those tweaks. And to be honest with you, it doesn't matter how good they were last week. You know, anyone could beat anyone. I mean, I'll be like, Jerry, I'll be honest with you. When it came to the Premiership final, I was a master of ceremonies at a wedding. Right. And I thought Quinn's did incredibly well to get to the final. If you'd asked me in the morning, and I didn't watch a lot of Premiership, who was going to win? I was like, Exeter. I didn't even think about it. Not because I didn't rate Harlequins. I just thought these guys have been to the final so many times. Halfway through the wedding, some bloke came running out to me and went, Harlequins a bit. I couldn't have been more happy. I was like, this is amazing. Not because I don't love Exeter, but the fact that I thought, what an amazing thing. It doesn't matter what happens into a game. It's people to deliver and you never fucking give up. You never, ever, you know, if you back yourself and you're together and those guys will be together and they'll be realised that there's an opportunity to win a test series on the third game, you know, against the box, anything can happen. And I really don't think, I know psychological stuff goes into it, but it's all to play for. I think these guys could front up and play out their skins and absolutely deliver.
Sort of final meaty question to you, because there's one more I want to ask Jerry just before we go. Lions lot are a really emotional bunch as fans. Everyone's all over the place and, oh God, it's all gone horribly wrong. I just want to know, as a current player, it isn't all about standing toe-to-toe. So you've already articulated how you just tweak a couple of things and suddenly it's a totally different game. Just for those who listen, who will tune in on Saturday, come kick-off at 5 o'clock, the Lions players will be full of belief, full of confidence, full of enthusiasm, full of energy. Any debate about that at all? Or will there be a lingering doubt because of what happened in the second test.
So obviously what we're saying here, what we've said for sort of the last 10 minutes, and it's reality, perception is reality in these situations. Everything from the outside at the moment is negative for the Lions. You look at the Sinks' biting incident they're talking about now. They spoke about hog biting. Razzie put that video out. Everything almost is like dawning down on the Lions and sort of pushing them to one side, empowering South Africa and putting them in the spot to win the game. For me, I know if I was in that camp, if I had I wouldn't stand up in front of everyone and say it, but if I was talking to my front row and in my pack, I'd say, fuck that. I'd say it's bollocks. Like, they had us in the scrum in a few occasions. I'd be chatting to my second rows. I'd say, I'm coming for these boys. Like, I'm coming for heads. Like, I'd be giving all my niggle to these South African boys trying to... Do you know what I mean? What have you got to lose?
Oh, no.
The worst that's going to happen is you're going to lose the game like the second test. You're going to roll over and let that happen, or you're going to fire up. And again, very easy for me to sit here and say that, but I know I'm getting a bit fired up thinking about it. I'd love to have the opportunity. I always think in my career, whenever I've been turned out by someone in a game or someone's hit me, like Curry's done it to me a few times, caught me late or hit me from the side, I've always had that animosity to think, I'm going to get you back. Whether you like it or not, like, I'm coming for you. And that's my mindset, what I'd be thinking going into the week. I'd be ready, I'd be blinkers on. Cool, I want everyone to think I'm going to lose. I want everyone to think I'm going to get turfed out in a scrum, because I know when it comes to that first, when the whistle goes, I'm bringing it, you know? Yeah. And I know a lot of people in that camp and how they tick, and I think that would be their mindset. I think the challenge, and what Jerry alluded to, would be to get everyone on that path. You wouldn't want people thinking, oh, we're just going to get turfed out again. They're going to dominate us here. They're going to do this. I think you need to focus on what can you do well. Mm. Like you said, the three things, what can you really go after? Because if you worry about someone else knocking you out all the time, that's what's going to happen. You know, if you keep thinking it, you got to try throw the knockout blow before them. And break their spirits, you know, because I know the SA boys, when they're going backwards, they start bickering amongst each other, you know. They do. You can see it on the pitch. They don't really trust each other when they're going backwards. They take it upon themselves. I think they packed the ball at the back off nine once in that first game. Like Jerry said, they're a very direct team. You know what's coming. So you can prep for that in the week. Let's hit them. Because that's what SA did, you know, like when it started to get all the little bits of niggle, which are important parts of the game. Like I said, it is fake. So you can't hit anyone unless you want to get sent off and actually lose the game. But those sort of psychological battles. You think about Mike Tyson when he used to stare people out and he said, I knew I beat him before the fight even started because he looked away. Those like little moments for me in games, I'm sure it resonates with a lot of players, they're massive. Like as soon as you see someone show their true colours or hide in their shell a little bit, that's it, you smell blood, you're going for it. Yeah. That's why if you're putting someone backwards in a scrum, I'm lifting shirts, you know, I'm slapping back. Because it makes people feel bad and they don't want to make the same mistake and it hurts egos. And I feel... SA really got on top in terms of the off-ball stuff, and even the ref said, I'm going to send someone off, because they all flew in, he couldn't really pick anyone out, you know. So I think there's got to be a little bit smarter with that.
Unless you're Dan Bigger, and Dan Bigger needs to stay away from any sort of contact. Did you see he ran in, he was like, what are you doing, Chief? Ran in, got hit on the back, folded up, fell on the floor and almost got trod on. It's like, Chief, that's not your area of expertise. That's not for you, bro. You stay well away. You point and shout from a safe distance.
And no one have a problem with it.
We don't need it. We don't need you to do that.
Jerry, the final question for you. Is Razzie Yakko Johan?
Oh, I have no idea. He says he's not, so I believe him. I have no idea, man. If he's got a burner Twitter account, I don't know.
Should we finish with a very quick prediction? I fear you're going to go South Africa, Jerry. Finish us with what's going to happen and why.
Yeah, I think it's going to be the box. Look, I'm intrigued because all the stuff we were laying out there, if the Lions win the first couple of aerial contests, you know, they start believing and they start like, as long as they believe they can win, that's the most important. You're not going to make guys better rugby players in a week or change their style. But if they believe, and if Warren Gatland can set things up and say, listen, if we can win the aerial game, if we get parity at the scrum, and if we can stop them mauling, we will win this game. And when the players start seeing that thing unfold, that's when they can come in. But I struggle to see the Lions doing it now. Okay. I think the momentum is with the box.
Ellis.
I want the Lions to win. They need ascendancy, and if they can get that back, I do think they'll win. But the ball's in South Africa's court at the moment.
Fair.
I'm going to go with the Lions.
I love you. You're such a feel-good chap.
Do you know why? Not purely because I think there is much more of this story to be written. Bits. We love the journey. We love the excitement. I back Warren. I back those guys to do it. I think, you know, as I said, it's not revolutionary what they need to improve. I said we've seen them beat South Africa. I see how good South Africa are. I obviously, you know, I'm fascinated what Jerry says about Razzie and Jack and the whole kind of coaching staff. But I want to back the Lions. I want that fairy tale to finish. I want the big box office moment, and what a story, no?
Yeah, I won about the Lions as well, yeah. But that's what we're saying. Well, who do you think is going to win?
I'm backing the Lions, Chief.
How much money are you putting in?
I don't gamble. There's plenty of people taking my money off me, whether it's lawsuits or unpaid bills. So
or lids.
Exactly.
Just your good word on the Lions. Jerry, we've absolutely loved it. And, you know, genuinely, I think the most interesting thing is just the different viewpoint you've offered of Rassi over the last hour, which at the moment everyone's sort of piling in and a lot of people have got a lot to say about him. But it's very, very interesting to get the views of someone who knows him extremely well. So thank you for that and enjoy pre-season. Your traps have deflated.
He's already
bit.
Out of preseason.
Well, I was going to say your traps have deflated the last hour, so you need to get back in the gym and pump those up again. But we hope it goes really well. We'd love to pop in and come and see Quinns and kind of see what you're doing and come and have a chat if that's a thing. But perhaps we can pick on that another time.
Can we do a little beach session and get me one of them vests?
Yeah, you'll have to ask Marler.
Marler, let me in. Sure. He's fine. He's on the firm. He's fine. I'll text him. All right.
Certainly not getting.
Well, then you're good to go, sir.
Jerry, thank you so much. Look after yourself. Really appreciate your time, and we would love to check in another time. Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
All the best. Fascinating guy.
Yeah, really interesting. I think just in the way he talks about Rassi Erasmus in terms of obviously a genius, but the way he managed the coaches, the emotional energy, obviously like a key component. And then to say that Jack was kind of the greatest rugby brain he'd ever worked with. Obviously, a lot of respect for them. That's why South Africa are in such a good place. You know, I wonder how much, and we didn't really get to go there too much, how much he's influenced his coaching style. Because I think the question you were going to ask, and which we didn't get to, was it takes a brave coach to let the lunatics run the asylum. Mm. And everyone I spoke to at Harlequins basically says that's what they're doing. You know, you also read some of the stuff around, they did very little contact.
None. It's about the Dommers, he said they did no contact. Yeah. They did one on-field session in that final week.
Yeah, and that's basically something very interesting about the progressive rugby stuff. They teamed up with some analysis company that did stuff around this stuff in gum shields.
That's right, chips and gum shields.
Chips and gum shields. And basically they just stopped doing contact and they looked fresh, they were physical, and they did it. And that kind of revolutionary stuff, I kind of like the fact that they won anyway, because it just goes to show new school thinking, feel good, you know, doing what you need to do. Is key. And also, like I said, empowerment of the lads. You know, I know the coaches don't want to take, you know, credit. They obviously, you know, manage stuff very well, but I love that.
I've really enjoyed this. I've really enjoyed you coming down.
Merci.
I've really enjoyed the fact we've actually spoken a bit of rugby, and I really enjoyed the fact that hopefully Lions fans out there who are throwing their toys and giving up and it's never going to happen. Actually, it's only a few tweaks here, a couple of selections there. You go again, and it's all on. It is going to be a belter.
How good is it to see Ellis back in front?
It's really good to see him.
Looking smart, isn't he?
Looking very smart, on brand. We've got to go. Just before we do, the Lions have had zero impact with their ball carriers. So imagine what a difference Ellis Genge could have made.
Well.
Ben Kay's column on Rugby Pass. Are you at peace with it, or are you like...
Yeah, I got asked it a lot, obviously, and I...
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Where am I at with it? I want them to do really well. I want them all to win. Obviously, from a selfish perspective, you'd love to have played. And obviously, watching that last game, I was thinking to myself, what could I have added to the party? But again, it's always easy to sit here and say, I could have done this, I could have done that. But you're not there. I want them to win. And that's the end of it.
Ben Kay actually said that on TalkSport when we did the commentary. He said, I'd love to see Ellis Genge. You fly him out.
He was saying it pre-tour as well.
One thing I'd like to do is I'd like to go there and get in amongst it in the small off-the-ball stuff. And,
yeah, me too. Yeah, I wanted to do
and just
well.
And just ruffle some feathers, you know. I think I get criticised a lot for it, but I think it's something that I'm good at, and I'd like to see how far you can push them. And
the only thing with it
it's
is though,
perfect series to that. No,
really, yeah.
Post Croatia, yeah. I reckon you've got 30 seconds in you before you were like, "Give us a minute, mate. Give us a minute."
Just get the mint leaves on.
Smelling salts. Good luck tomorrow with the run.
Thank you.
What a show! We have been the Good, the Bad, and the Rugby. In partnership with City Index, thank you again to them for their support throughout the Lions tour. We have one more show to go before you can all have a summer holiday. We've got an end of season do next week. Best game, best player, worst game, best lid. Send some suggestions in, actually. What questions can we get into? At Good Bad Rugby for that. For now, though, well done, Ellis. Lovely to see you. Good on your half. Here's Rob Brydon.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.